Welcome to Thursday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen in for Melody, who has the week off due to a death in the family. A special shout out today to Vicky, my new friend and future client from southeastern Pennsylvania. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you my humble opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Today is Thursday, September 16, 2021. Happy Guacamole Day. It's also National Step Family Day. And did you know that on this day in 1908, William Durant and Charles Stuart Mott founded the General Motors Corporation? Well, now you do. Thanks in advance to our producer and engineer, Todd. Let's get started with today's market report. Bear with me as we pull that up. A rough day for precious metals. Gold right now in the New York spot aftermarket down $39 and change at $17.56, we'll round it to. Silver down 92 cents at $23.01. Platinum down $12 at $9.38. Palladium, the exception, up $26 to $2,111. Now, in the other commodity markets, after a fall for throughout most of the day, domestic crude oil, West Texas, is up barely, roughly the same, $72.62 a barrel. International Brent up 21 cents at $75.67. Gold futures, by the way, December gold futures in the U.S. down $40, $1,754. In the Treasury markets, virtually all yields up today. 3 month was unchanged. You have the bellwether 10-year up 0.034 to close at 1.338%. The 2-year up a tad to 0.221. And the 30-year note up 0.017, close at 1.886. That all coming on a jump in the dollar up 0.31 to 92.86. And in the paper markets, let's see, across the oceans, you got European markets were up for the day. Chinese, Japanese markets down. In the U.S. Right now, let's see, it looks like the S&P closed down about 7 points at 4,474. Dow Jones down 63, to close at 34,751. NASDAQ up $20 to close at about 15,182. Gold certainly down after investors reacting quite negatively to the rise in retail sales and regional manufacturing activity. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, the number of Americans seeking unemployment benefits moved up last week to 332,000 from a prior pandemic low, sign that the spread of the Delta variant may have slightly increased layoffs. Applications for jobless aid rose from 312,000 the week before. It's according to the Labor Department weekly report out this morning. That 312,000 figure, by the way, was the lowest level since March of last year. Jobless claims, which generally track the pace of layoffs, have fallen steadily for 2 months now, as many employers struggling to fill jobs have held on to their workers. Last week's increase was relatively small and is expected to be temporary. The four-week average of jobless claims, which smooths out fluctuations in the weekly data, dropped for the fifth straight week to just below 336,000, which also happens to be the lowest since the pandemic began. Unemployment applications jumped 4,000 in Louisiana, evidence that Hurricane Ida led to widespread job losses there. Ida will likely nick the economy's overall growth rate in the current third quarter, though repairs and rebuilding efforts are expected to make up for at least some of that in the coming months afterwards. Still, Ida shut down oil refineries in Louisiana and Mississippi about 2 weeks ago and left more than a million homes and businesses there without any electricity. But Ida's impact is looking limited for now. Applications for jobless aid fell slightly in Mississippi, although that could stem from people not being able to get to their local unemployment office, either in person or online. Now, the job market and broader economy have been slowed in recent weeks by the Delta variant, which has discouraged a lot of Americans from traveling, staying in hotels, and again, eating out. Earlier this month, the government reported that employers added just 235,000 jobs in August after having added almost a million people in both June and July. Hiring in August plummeted in industries that require face-to-face contact with the public, notably restaurants, hotels, and retailers. Still, some jobs were added in other areas, and the government's headline U3 unemployment rate actually dropped to 5.2% from 5.4, although it's important to keep in mind that the more realistic U6 rate is still over 9%. Steady fall in weekly applications for unemployment benefits coincides with the scaling back of aid for jobless Americans. Last week, more than 8 million people lost all of their unemployment benefits with the expiration of two federal programs that covered gig workers and people who have been jobless for more than 6 months. Those emergency programs were created by the CARES Act in March 2020 when the pandemic first tore through the economy. An additional 2.7 million people who are receiving regular state unemployment aid lost their $300 a week federal unemployment supplement last week. Now, retail sales posted a surprise gain in August, despite fears that escalating COVID cases and supply chain issues would hold back customers. According to the Commerce Department, which reported the latest numbers again this morning, retail sales increased 0.7% for the month against economists' estimates of a decline of 0.8%. Economists had expected that consumers had cut back their activity as the Delta variant continued its tear through the U.S. Persistent supply chain bottlenecks also were expected to hold back spending, as in-demand goods continue to be hard to find. But how they spent continues to be skewed by the pandemic. Online shopping jumped in August, but spending at restaurants, bars, and other businesses that rely on in-person crowds appear to have gone into a holding pattern. The pandemic's impact did show up in sales at bars and restaurants, which were flat for the month, though still 32% ahead of where they were a year ago. However, sales were strong for most categories during the month, when back to school shopping generally results in a pickup in activity, especially so this year as schools prepared to welcome back students after a year of remote learning. The headline number would have been even better without a 3.6% monthly drop in auto-related activity. Excluding that sector, sales rose 1.8%, also well above the adjusted 0.1% expected game. With concerns rising over the pandemic, shoppers have turned online, with non-store sales jumping 5.3%. Furniture and home furnishings also saw a healthy 3.7% increase, while general merchandise sales rose 3.5%. Electronics and appliance stores saw a 3.1% drop, while sporting goods and music stores fell 2.7%. Now, the numbers overall still reflected a more resilient consumer, with sales up 15% from the same period a year ago. Sales at department stores overall also rose 2.4% last month. Now, the retail report covers only about a third of overall consumer spending and excludes services like haircuts and hotel stays and, well, airline tickets. And there's clear evidence that spending has waned in at least some of those industries. Airlines, for example, have reported a drop-off in ticket sales. Again, they're blaming the spread of the Delta variant. Auto sales, again, continued to fall last month, 3.9%, likely because fewer cars were made due to that shortage of microchips, which are needed to power screens and other tech features in cars. Some economists are still hoping, however, for a larger bump in consumer activity during the rest of this year. We shall see. Now, in a separate economic report, growth of manufacturing activity in the Philadelphia region gathered pace in September after several months of slowing down. At least that's according to the latest survey released today by the Philly Fed. The index for the current general activity climbed to 30.7 so far this month from 19.4 in August, well above the 18.7 expected from economists. Now, the survey polls manufacturers in the 3rd Federal Reserve District, which covers eastern PA, southern New Jersey, and Delaware, about the direction of change in overall business activity at their plants. A reading of zero indicates a reading above zero indicates expansion. The index signals that overall manufacturing activity in the region continued to expand and its pace rebounded compared with the previous 2 months. Factory activity in the U.S. overall keeps rising, though there's growing evidence that problems related to getting components and raw materials are really limiting output. These supply chain shortages aren't expected to clear soon. I think we mentioned the other day that now some people are saying, this disruption could continue through the end of 2022 and possibly into 2023 in some industries. In September, 33% of firms in the Philly district reported increases in overall activity. Just 3% reported decreases. Demand-related indicators posted mixed readings. The new orders index eased to about 16 from 23 the previous month, while the shipments index increased a good bit to 30 from about 19. Again, not surprisingly, the employment index cooled to 26 from 32.6. Still signaling increases in employment, but at a 20% slower pace than the month before. And the indicators for prices paid and prices received remained elevated, but posted small declines. The index for general activity over the next 6 months fell to 20 from 34, roughly, the previous month. And the future new orders index and employment indexes also decreased. That's in the Philly area. Now, the news out of Philly does come on the heels of news yesterday that industrial production has joined metrics like GDP and consumer spending that have returned to and even surpassed pre-pandemic levels. But I'll tell you what I'd like to do here for a second. I just saw a news flash here that I think is pretty significant. We talked the other day, or I talked the other day, about or could have been last week, I guess, about some questionable investing by a couple of the Fed presidents. Today, just now we're learning Fed Chair Jerome Powell has directed staff to review the Fed's ethics rules for appropriate financial activities after those disclosures that a number of senior central bank officials made multiple multi-million dollar stock trades last year, while others held significant investments and not in blind trusts. News of Powell's inquiry broke after Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts sent letters to the Fed's 12 regional bank presidents demanding stricter ethics from the nation's top central bank officials. She called on each Fed president to institute a ban on the ownership and trading of individual stocks by senior officials at each regional office. A Fed spokesperson said that Powell last week ordered a fresh and comprehensive look at the ethics rules around permissible financial holdings and activities by senior Fed officials. Now, Powell ordered the review, quote, because the trust of the American people is essential for the Federal Reserve to effectively carry out our important mission. This review will assist in identifying ways to further tighten those rules and standards. Went on to say the board will make changes as appropriate, including changes to the Reserve Bank Code of Conduct. Documents released last week showed that Dallas Fed President Robert Kaplan made multiple trades worth $1 million or more last year in individual stocks, including Apple, Amazon, and Delta Air. Boston Fed President Eric Rosengren held stakes in four real estate investment trusts and several purchases and sales of similar property-owning vehicles. He also held stock in Pfizer, Chevron, and AT&T. His investments were in the tens to hundreds of thousands of dollars. Now, other Fed presidents, such as Richmond Fed Pres Thomas Barkin, disclosed little or no trading activity, but a number of financial holdings in excess of $1 million, including Coke stock worth more than $500,000, at least $1 million in Vanguard's energy fund, Admiral shares. That's a mutual fund that invests in energy companies like ConocoPhillips, Marathon Petroleum, and BP. Well, I hear that sound. That means we're at the end of the first segment. It's time for a couple of important messages. I hope you'll stay tuned. I'll be back in a few minutes. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSC Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSC Talk Radio. TheTimeRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen in for Melody. 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Hey, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Today's topic, lobsters, the resiliency of the human spirit, and, well, staying young at heart. When Virginia Oliver started trapping lobsters off Maine's rocky coast, World War II was still more than a decade away. The electronic traffic signal was just a recent invention, and few women were harvesting lobsters. Well, now nearly a century later, at age 101, she's still doing it. The oldest lobster fisher in the state and possibly in the world. Ms. Oliver still faithfully tends to her traps off Rockland, Maine with her 78-year-old son, Max. Oliver started trapping lobsters at age 8, she says, and these days she catches them using a boat that once belonged to her late husband and that bears her own name, the Virginia. She said she has no intentions of stopping, but she is concerned about the health of Maine's lobster population, which she said is subject to heavy fishing pressure these days. Oliver said, "I've done it all my life, so I might as well keep doing it." And that's the spirit. The lobster industry has changed a lot over the course of Oliver's many decades on the water, and lobsters have grown from a working-class food to, well, a delicacy. The lobsters fetched 28 cents a pound on the docks when she first started trapping them. Now, a mere 15 times that amount. Wire traps have replaced her beloved old wooden ones, which these days are used as kitsch in seafood restaurants. Other aspects, though, are remarkably similar. She's still loading pogies. That's lobster speak for menhaden, a small fish, into traps to lure the crustaceans in. And she's still getting up long before dawn to get on the boat and do it. She was destined for this life, she says, in many ways. Her father was a lobster dealer starting around the turn of the century, the 20th. And instilled a love of the business in Oliver, who would join him on trips as a younger girl. Wayne Gray, a family friend who lives nearby, said Oliver had a brief scare a couple of years ago when a crab snipped her finger. She had to get 7 stitches. She even considered hanging up her lobster traps. The doctor admonished her, "Why are you still out there lobstering?" She said, "Because I want to." Well, after all these years, Oliver still gets excited about a lobster dinner of her own and typically fixes one for herself about once a week. She has no plans to quit anytime soon. "I like doing it," she said. "I like being on the water, and so I'm going to keep on doing it just as long as I can." As my daughters would say, ladies and gentlemen, you go, girl. And that is this week's Levity is Golden. Now, on a less levity-like sense, Democratic leadership in the House and Senate are working on a short-term funding bill, there we go again, which needs to pass by the end of the month to avoid a government shutdown. That includes a debt limit increase. As we mentioned the other week, the country will default on its debt in October for the first time in U.S. history if Congress doesn't increase the federal debt limit or waive it. As we taxpayers observe from the sidelines, Republicans and Democrats have entered a standoff. Go figure. Now they're daring the other side to blink. Republican lawmakers are saying they'll refuse to vote for a short-term funding bill that deals with raising the debt ceiling. They're arguing that Democrats have the tools to deal with the deficit on their own since they control both the White House and both houses of Congress. The GOP plans to try to force Democrats to strip debt ceiling language from any continuing resolution, which needs at least 10 Republican senators to pass. Republicans say that Democrats should instead rewrite their reconciliation bill to include the debt increase in their $3.5 trillion infrastructure spending package. Well, Democratic leadership has repeatedly insisted they will not tweak that budget, especially since it's passed both chambers. One other option, Democrats could also try to pass a debt limit increase as a standalone bill, but Republicans say they won't vote for that either. The most practical option, according to many Republicans like Chuck Grassley of Iowa, says Democrats should introduce a deficit increase and ask for unanimous consent to take up the bill without a filibuster, thus not requiring any GOP senators to vote for it. Grassley asked, and why would a Republican object? Well, one Republican, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, is objecting. Cruz says he'll force a filibuster if Democrats try to raise the debt ceiling that way. The bottom line, the issue's going to consume most of the oxygen on Capitol Hill in the coming weeks. That despite Congress's other rapidly approaching deadlines. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen warned again just last week that a default would cause irreparable damage to the U.S. economy and global financial markets. And for that very reason alone, ladies and gentlemen, I'll say again what we said the other week and last week. Congress will pass some form of a bill that includes a resolution on the debt ceiling. Certainly take that to the market. Now, landmines for the paper markets in particular are becoming more numerous. Seasonal weakness is combining with continuing uncertainty over the impact of the Delta variant on consumer behavior, high labor and material costs affecting pricing and delivery of goods, and poor data coming out of China. And while the S&P is still only 1% from its all-time highs, those landmines are taking their toll on large sectors of the markets. CFRA's Sam Stovall says, for the last several months, most stocks have declined more frequently than they've advanced, and that's evidence of a weakening market. Other strategists have noticed this divergence as well. Guggenheim's Scott Minard said, in the past, such divergence has indicated the market is vulnerable to a sell-off. Well, about 15% of the big cap S&P 500 are more than 20% below 52-week highs, but much larger swaths of the mid-cap and small-cap universe are down 20% or more. Now, those groups are less tech-focused and more susceptible to an economic slowdown. Well, here's how many companies in the S&P are 20% or more below their 52-week highs right now. Overall, the S&P 500, 50%. The S&P mid-cap stocks, 30%. And the S&P small-cap companies, 48%. That's a lot, almost half. Again, new COVID-related weakness is affecting sectors associated with a reopening across the country, such as industrials and retail. Blarina Yerucci from Too Big to Fail Barclays says this phase of the pandemic poses downside risks to the economic recovery, including to inflation components that are more sensitive to the disruption in services demand. Well, here are the largest industrials that are off their 52-week high. You have American Airlines, 26%. FedEx 20, DuPont 20, PP&G 18, Caterpillar 17, Stanley Black & Decker also 17, defense contractor Lockheed Martin 14, and 3M 12. And retailers, you have Nordstrom down 41%, Gap 36, Abercrombie 24, Kohl's 19, Ross 16. The China slowdown, particularly the decline in retail sales, is dramatically affecting luxury retailers, many of them based in Europe, like Kering down 21%, Tapestry 20, and Richemont 17. And of course, supply chain and labor problems are affecting the ability of some home builders to fully deliver on orders. Here are some of the top public home builders who are off their 52-week highs. You have Pulte down 26%, KB Home 21%, and D.R. Horton down 17%. Last but not least, concerns about controls on drug prices is also affecting Big Pharma. Over the past couple of weeks, Eli Lilly's off 14% from its 52-week high. Bristol-Myers Squibb and Merck both off 11%, and Johnson & Johnson off 8%. So despite all these signs, many are asking, well, why are so many analysts and strategists remaining bullish? Well, it appears to be all based on the theory that the Delta variant will prove to be a temporary and diminishing force. And importantly, that earnings will not materially decline as a result. That remains to be seen, ladies and gentlemen. Don't take your chances. Stick with gold and silver. Now, some analysts are saying that the invention of stable coins means that there are now so-called currencies that claim to have no risk of depreciating against the dollar. If you can believe that. And a lot of people apparently do. Those currencies also have yields vastly higher than anything seen in the bond market right now, setting up all the ingredients for an enormous carry trade. This is how it works. On September 7th, Coinbase CEO Brian Armstrong wondered, how can lending be a security? Well, exactly 1 week later, Coinbase issued $2 billion in bonds, paying about 3.4% in the 7-year tranche and roughly 3.6 for 10 years. The pricing was expensive by corporate bond standards and even expensive by junk bond standards. Coinbase ended up paying about 6.5 basis points more than most other companies carrying the same BB plus credit rating, but by crypto standards, the funding was still considered dirt cheap. Coinbase, in a lending product it contemplated, was promising to pay a 4% yield on USDC. That's the dollar-linked stablecoin it's associated with, USDC. Other companies happen to pay a lot more. BlockFi, for example, pays as much as 8% interest on USDC, which is roughly what Gemini pays on its Gemini dollar. People borrowing dollar proxy coins at 8% are doing so essentially because the traditional banking system is still uncomfortable lending against crypto assets. Rightly so, in my mind. All crypto lending is over-collateralized and is set up with automatic margin calls. And that makes it very safe and minimize any credit risk, according to the lenders. For players with access to fiat borrowing markets like Coinbase, that sets up a very simple carry trade. You borrow U.S. dollars, lend U.S. dollar stablecoins, and make free money on the spread between the two. However, as we know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. There are still all manners of risk involved in a trade like this. And in fact, there's no indication that Coinbase is going to lend its dollars out in the form of USDC rather than putting them to any number of alternative or corporate uses. So if you're taking the plunge in cryptos, you best be to remember that just because the spread between US dollar and USDC yields is incredibly large at the moment, and even if crypto succeeds in maturing as an asset class, that likely won't last long. Just be sure you're okay with the risk of your stablecoin investment imploding with no notice whatsoever. Be careful out there. Now, why is France so ticked off at the U.S. today? Well, it seems that Australia's canceled a big contract with France for conventional submarines. Instead, it's going to build nuclear-powered submarines with U.S. technology. That's apparently because of changing strategic conditions in the region, according to Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison. Yesterday, President Biden announced a new U.S. security alliance with Australia and Britain that will help equip Australia with a new nuclear submarine fleet. The agreement would make Australia the first country without nuclear weapons to obtain nuclear-powered submarines. Morrison said U.S. nuclear submarine technology wasn't available to Australia in 2016 when it entered a $43 billion deal with France to build 12 of the world's largest conventional diesel electric submarines. The U.S. has previously only shared the nuclear technology with the U.K. Biden didn't mention China by name in announcing the new security alliance, but it's likely to be seen as a provocative move by Beijing, whose military strength and influence in the region in particular have grown rapidly. Peter Jennings, who heads Australian Strategic Policy Institute think tank, said Australia's decision to acquire a nuclear submarine was a response to China's increasing military might. Plus, its aggressive bullying of Australia and intimidation of Japan and Taiwan. Jennings said, we should call the first submarine in this new category the Xi Jinping, because no person is more responsible for Australia going down this track than the current leader of the Chinese Communist Party. Well, Australia notified France that it will end its contract with DCNS, that's a majority state-owned company, to build the conventional submarines. Australia has spent $1.8 billion on the project since 2016. The first of the French subs was to have been delivered in 2027. Of course, French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian expressed total incomprehension at the decision and criticized both Australia and the United States. Other reports today said France President's Macron was beside himself when he learned of this. Morrison said he expects the first of the nuclear subs will be built by 2040. Now, left out of the new alliance is Australia's South Pacific neighbor, New Zealand, which enacted policies in the 1980s to ensure that it remains nuclear free. That's it for this segment. We're going to leave you for a couple of more important messages. And I'll be back after that. You're listening to Financial Survival. Please stick around.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on shortwave radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Hey, one more time. Welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Look us up on the web at DGScoins.com, DGScoins.com, or check out our Facebook page at DGScoins. That's the at sign, DGScoins. Now, Pam and Russ Martins, the founders of Wall Street on Parade, are a frequent source of some of our news and opinions on financial survival. Well, today is no different. They remind us in their latest newsletter that during the financial collapse of 2008, money market funds found themselves holding toxic paper that no one wanted to buy. To stop panic runs on the money market funds, on September 19, 2008, the Treasury Department issued a statement indicating it would guarantee more than $3.5 trillion in money market funds. Well, as COVID concerns took root in March last year and the stock market plunged, the Fed launched another bailout program for those money market funds. On March 18, 2020, the Money Market Mutual Fund Liquidity Facility, we'll call it MILF for short, was created and run out of the Boston Fed. Well, going forward, the Fed doesn't want to be in the position of having to bail out more privately owned money market funds. So it's been seducing money market funds and other financial institutions to use its overnight reverse repurchase agreement program for the assets they need to keep both safe and liquid. A reverse repo transaction occurs when the open market trading desk at the New York Fed sells a security, typically a treasury bond, to one of its approved counterparties with an agreement to repurchase that same security at a specified price at a specified, specific time in the future, typically the next day. The difference between the sale price and the repurchase price, adjusted for the length of time between the sale and the purchase, that's the implied rate of interest. The Martins say the Fed's seduction program has taken a number of forms since March of this year. For example, on March 18th, the Federal Open Market Committee minutes indicate the Fed authorized raising the reverse repo per counterparty limit from $30 billion per day to $80 billion per day. At the same time, it also gave the Fed chair the power to temporarily increase that limit at his discretion. Later on April 30th, the New York Fed, which operates the reverse repo program for the Fed, reduced the dollar amount of its eligibility criteria for users. For example, the requirement that participating mutual funds had to have net assets over the prior 6 months of at least $5 billion was reduced to just $2 billion. You got to wonder who that concession was made for and who on the New York Fed they knew. Then on June 16th, the Fed raised the interest rate it was paying for reverse repos from 0 to 0.05%. Thus, making it the highest paying safe game in town at 0.05%. We live in interesting times. According to the Martins, the seduction has worked. Almost every big name mutual fund company is now listed as a counterparty to the Fed's reverse repos, including AllianceBernstein, American Funds, BlackRock, Dreyfus, Federated, Fidelity, Franklin, Schwab, T. Rowe Price, and Vanguard. Counterparties also include the too big to fail Wall Street banks like J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, Citibank, and Goldman Sachs. And yes, government-sponsored enterprises such as several regional Federal Home Loan Banks, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, showing just how well the Fed's enticements have worked. The daily uptake has increased from less than a billion a day at the end of last year to over 1 trillion a day since mid-August. The number, that's mid-August this year, the number of counterparties participating currently ranges from 70 to more than 80 on any given day. That's up from a range of 40 to 50 at the end of May. You can see why. The adverse consequences of the Fed's massive new interventions in the so-called free markets is yet to be tested. Even the Fed itself has reservations, or at least it did. I mean, in a 2015 Fed paper titled Overnight Reverse Repo Operations as a Monetary Policy Tool, researchers noted this, I'm quoting, "Most importantly, a permanently expanded role for the Federal Reserve in short-term funding markets could reshape the financial industry in ways that may be difficult to anticipate and that may prove to be undesirable. For example, a permanent or long-lasting facility that causes very significant crowding out of short-term financing could lead to atrophying of the private infrastructure that supports these markets. Partially in response to some of these concerns, the FOMC has made clear that a reverse repo facility is not intended to be permanent," end quote. As the Martins conclude, quantitative easing was never intended to be a permanent feature of the Fed, even when it was adopted after the 2008 financial collapse. And yet, here we are 13 years later, the Fed using QE now on steroids to buy up $120 billion a month in treasuries and agency mortgage-backed securities. The more things change, ladies and gentlemen, the more they remain the same. Now, I thought this was interesting. We won't spend a lot of time on it, but California is estimated to receive the largest number of Afghan refugees, about 5,200 plus, who are coming to America, followed by Texas at about 4,500. This according to newly, I don't know if it was released or leaked, State Department data. Hawaii, South Dakota, West Virginia, and Wyoming are the only states of our 50 not slated to receive anyone from the first group of evacuees, including Washington, D.C. The Biden administration notified governors and mayors yesterday of the number of Afghan evacuees their states expected to receive in the coming weeks. An initial group of 37,000 Afghans will soon be headed to states across the country, again, many after adventurous, even harrowing journeys from Afghanistan. Most evacuees or more evacuees are waiting in third countries. The administration has requested funding from Congress to help resettle 65,000 Afghans in the U.S. by the end of this month and 95,000 by September of 2022. Interesting story. We'll keep you informed if we hear any updates to that in the coming weeks. Now, big tech. Still in the news, something always seeming to going on there. I don't know if you caught this news yesterday. Now, we know Facebook employs hundreds of researchers. Many of them have PhDs. And we learned yesterday that they found some shocking patterns. They include how Facebook makes users angrier and girls deeply insecure. Now, this is according to an ongoing Wall Street Journal series called The Facebook Files. The series is based on a bunch of internal Facebook research reports, plus online employee discussions. The journal says at least some of the documents have been turned over to the SEC and Congress by a person seeking federal whistleblower protection. Hardest hitting installment so far, called Facebook Knows Instagram is Toxic, reports this. Repeatedly, the company's researchers found that Facebook-owned Instagram is harmful for a sizable percentage of young users, most notably teenage girls. Facebook's researchers identified the over-sexualization of girls as something that weighs on the mental health of the app's users. In response, Karina Newton, who is Instagram's head of public policy, said, "We're proud that our app can give voice to those who have been marginalized, that it can help friends and family stay connected from all corners of the world, and that it can prompt societal change. But we also know it can be a place where people have negative experiences." Adam Azari, who is head of Instagram, said this about the journal account of research into young people's experiences on their platform. Quote, "We stand by this work and believe more companies should be doing the same." That's a pretty incredible candor coming from someone in that industry, something that I feel has been sorely lacking over the last few years in particular. Now, the third and latest installment of the journal series, Facebook tried to make its platform a healthier place. It got angrier instead. Reports on the effects of a major overhaul of the newsfeed algorithm a couple of years ago. It says Facebook researchers concluded that the new algorithm's heavy weighting of reshared material made the angry voices louder. Misinformation, toxicity, and violent content are inordinately prevalent among these reshares, these researchers noted in internal memos. Definitely more reason to keep your teens away from social media, ladies and gentlemen. And while you're at it, limit your own time there, too. Now, here's an interesting story. A new generation of 911 would allow the nation's 6,000 911 call centers to accept text, videos, and photos. U.S. emergency communications have remained stubbornly analog since 911 was introduced a couple of decades ago, but Congress is about to take another run at dragging 911 into the digital age, giving people ways to reach 911 beyond voice calls. In fact, could save citizens and first responder lives. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar, who co-chairs the Senate's Next Generation 911 Caucus, and Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada introduced a bill today that would create a $10 billion federal grant program for upgrades to the nation's 911 centers. Klobuchar said, "In a crisis, no one should be put in danger because of outdated 911 systems. And first responders, public safety officials, and law enforcement must be able to communicate seamlessly." Similarly, the House Energy and Commerce Committee approved its own proposal this week for a $10 billion boost for next-gen 911 as part of the $3.5 trillion spending package. Expanding 911 to accept more kinds of digital data would certainly add more resiliency to a system that's still built around a copper-based telephone network. According to the FCC, almost 3,000 911 centers are capable of receiving text messages, but none have full capacities to take data from smartphones. Harriet Renee Brown, who is executive director of the National Association of State 911 Administrators, said, "You have this amazing device in your hand, and we can't use all the information it's capable of sending us." Yeah, that doesn't appear to be good. House Energy and Commerce Committee Chair Frank Pallone in New Jersey said, "Next Gen 911 is about saving lives. Americans are enduring the most frequent and severe natural disasters in recorded history. Meanwhile, our 911 operators are being asked to respond with outdated technology from a bygone era. Now, the other side, interestingly, Republicans opposed the House proposal during a marathon markup session earlier this week after Democrats voted against all Republican amendments. One Republican amendment would have prohibited the new funding to go to 911 centers in cities that voted to defund their police departments. The House proposal would not allow the funding to go to states that divert funds from the 911 fees on consumer phone bills to non 911 purposes. So we'll see how that goes. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that as the fall comes upon us. Now, last today, ladies and gentlemen, in one of the worst years ever for our economy and labor market, America's poverty rate actually dropped, according to a report out of the Commerce Department Census Bureau the other day. It underscores the major impact that stimulus checks, expanded unemployment payments, and other benefits had on households last year, even as millions lost their jobs. Without them, and of course other safety nets like Social Security, the poverty rate would jump for the first time in 5 years by one percentage point to 11.4%. Now, the poverty rate typically cited each year focuses solely on cash income, but an alternate rate that includes these major aid programs took on new significance because of the pandemic stimulus injected into the economy. And with that, it fell to 9.1%, the lowest rate since the government started publishing this data in 2009. So they say stimulus checks lifted 12 million Americans out of poverty, while expanded unemployment's lifted over 5 million. Hey, that's the end of today's program. I'll be on vacation next week. Butch will be here tomorrow. Melody back Monday. Also be on the lookout tomorrow for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks for listening to Financial Survival. Have a good evening, and please be safe out there. Bye-bye.